Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I am delighted, and I'm always delighted because we only have great guests on the show. I don't just say this, right? I'm not just saying it. We only have great guests on the show. So today I'd like to welcome Rick Azzaro to the show. Great to see you, Rick. Thank you so much.
Great to see you as well, Simon, and thank you for the opportunity to advocate and join this podcast with you.
You're an absolute star. It's a pleasure to have you. It's a pleasure to have you aboard. So could you share, tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I have spent my entire career, which culminates in, as much as I hate to say it, 31 years of working with victims of child maltreatment and family violence in the United States of America, both in the state of Pennsylvania and Maryland. I started as a young man and knew this is what I would want to do for the rest of my life when I worked in a residential facility for young boys and was just amazed at the experiences that they had, their resiliency, their wisdom. And then I was appalled by the prospect that they had no one on this planet to love them and support them unconditionally. And I saw the human potential in their little faces and was horrified at the lack of supports in their little world. So, I decided at that moment, at the ripe young age of 20, that I would devote my life to this work, that this was a noble cause, and that someone needed to be there to be a voice for these kids. I'm presently the executive director of Voce, and Voce actually means voice, and we have recently rebranded our organization because we believe strongly in both advocacy, using our voice, and helping others to use theirs through empowerment. So I'm pleased to be in this field, and I am a perpetual learner. Although I have a certain degree of expertise, what I know is that I'm learning each and every day new things that help people. And I think we do that mostly through our empathy and our listening.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, so you've been in this field 36 years, and looking at you, I'm going to say that that means that you started work when you were six, is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
It was like some kind of Charles Dickens moment where you were sent up chimneys.
Exactly.
With the little skinny one and clean chimneys, and then you came down and you thought, this is going to be my life. It is a very youthful, we're recording this on Zoom, listeners, he's a very youthful, energetic guy, and obviously clearly driven by a passion and the fact that this hit you at 20, this insight, this is what I do, hit you at 20. That's what's keeping you young, my friend.
Yes. Well, at 20, I'm not too far from being a boy myself. I could make an argument that 20-year-old young men are really still boys as much as they are. And I think that probably had a influence on my connection with other boys and looking at them and saying, I've been a boy before, but I don't know your experience as a boy. But I know the world has been rough. It makes you count your blessings, but also say, what can I bring to the table? How can I join you to help actualize your potentials and your possibilities together?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So actualizing our potentials. So that to me sounds a bit like my thriving. Yeah. A bit like my thriving. So we are kindred spirits, listeners. Obviously you can hear that, I'm sure. So what is it? What is it that helps us thrive? What is it that helps adoptees thrive? What is it that helps adopters thrive? What is it? What do you think that's all about?
Well, I think there's a couple things. I know you and I had previously talked about post-traumatic growth and the difference between surviving and thriving. One thing I do think that I've learned over my years is some regard for ignorance and humility. Thriving to me doesn't mean that people tell you who you should be or tell you what your potential and your possibilities. There's an authentic process to this that only an individual can determine those things for themselves. So I think we have mistaken in the world sometimes of parenting and also helping children is to dictate who we think they should be or who we want them to be. So for me, thriving is a very individualized, very personal place that a person can occupy that they determine and are empowered to pursue what it means for them to be, to grow, to have potential, but more importantly, to be them all, their authentic selves.
Yeah.
And why I use that, why I brought that up, Simon, is I think there are a lot of well-intentioned people that will tell children how children should be and what they should be. But the truth of the matter is we're really, as individuals, that's kind of a task for each of us separately to determine. And we'll do that through a lifetime of asking questions. So for me, thriving is past survival. It is past just the developmental aspects of maturation. And it goes to something about being your authentic self. And you determine that through your journey and the supports, the questions, and the insights that come your way.
Yeah. So you've mentioned questions a couple of times here. Now, my take on that and pulling the threads out of what you just said, my take would be that it's about asking questions to help others, you know, see their own potential.
Sure. I guess in my lifetime, I think the questions oftentimes are more important than the answers. The questions we ask for ourselves, the questions we ask of each other to prompt kind of a personal discovery. And, you know, I think there are a lot of ways we can support adoptees. But to me, it all begins with a sense of humility and ignorance, is that we come to an individual who has their own subjective experience. And what empathy can do is allow us to try to understand that subjective experience and check our own biases. But the truth of the matter is there is no professional that will know exactly another person's experience unless they can practice authentic empathy and really a sense of humility. So I think everything starts there. Any individual, including adoptees that are on a journey through their lifetime, trying to sort out what their life means. If there are supports in place, those supports should start with a sense of humility and empathy. There is a body of knowledge and we understand certain things, and those are applicable at times, but I think they're only beneficial when they arrive out of an empathic relationship with an individual. For example, when we talk about adoptees, it's not surprising that there are, like the rest of us, identity issues, issues of grief and loss, potential trauma, attachment issues, family loyalties and trust, all sorts of adjustment issues. Well, we may know that, but what that actually means for that individual is where that humility and empathy come into play if a professional or a friend is willing to help. And I think with adoptees, there are certain unique circumstances that they can certainly have questions about in their lives that a lot of systems don't understand. I can speak for the US of A that our mental health providers oftentimes don't understand some of the unique dynamics inherent in the adoption experience, both for the adoptee and the adoptive family. So a lot of time is spent on getting them to practice that sense of humility and to know what kinds of things that, that an adoptee may be struggling with. But really, it goes back to the name of my organization, which I'm very proud of, is Whose Voice Matters? And the question of who am I is not the professional's question, it's the adoptee's question. And can we listen to that voice, and can we do, through a process of discovery, have conversations and look at things together to help people get to that thriving place?
Yeah, wow. So you said something very interesting before, we said a few very interesting things before we started recording, but you said about, so it's not, we were talking about it not being our fault, something that happened to us, the adoption stuff. I can't remember. Can you,
correct.
Can you tell us more?
Sure. We were talking a little bit about trauma. And one of the things I'm very pleased to see during the course of my career is movement away. With a trauma perspective, we've moved from not what's wrong with you, which is very medical model, very prescriptive, very blaming, to a trauma perspective of what happened to you. And what it does is take the stigma and the blame off of individuals that have struggles. And I'm optimistic that that will continue to move in a direction where we really have a compassion for individuals' experience and the consequences of those experience in their own lives and their functioning and their relationships and how they see the world. So I'm really pleased during the course of my career to see us move from, because I'll tell you, when I started off, these were problem children. That's what they were called when I worked with them. And it was never comfortable to me to feel like these were problem children when you understood their history of trauma and you wonder yourself if you could have even survived it. And the fact that that child was sitting there staring you in the face, maybe with a soccer ball in their hand or a basketball, and still alive, meant they were resilient and survivors. But yet we still called them problem children at once upon a time. So, you know, I'm hopeful that those stigmas go away over time and we erode that very paternalistic sort of adult perspective and kind of reach down to the child and say, let me share your space a little bit and understand you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I shared again before recording. I shared the hope, the most hopeful moment I've seen in quite a while, when I discovered this thing called post-traumatic growth. This morning I heard somebody talking about post-traumatic growth, and I thought, isn't that absolutely fantastic that we have gone from PTSD to something called post-traumatic growth. And why aren't we hearing more about this? And you nodded, and you've been aware of this. So that must be the light at the end of the tunnel that everybody's kind of waiting for, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a paradigm shift in the sense that we're saying not only is trauma inherent in everybody's lives in micro, smaller formats and larger formats, but not only the capacity to work through your trauma individually used to stop at a survivor sort of destination, for lack of a better word. And I just remember a survivor saying to me, once upon a time in my career, I worked at a rape crisis center. And one of the survivors looked at me and she said, I'm not a survivor, I'm a thriver. And what she meant by that was not only had she challenged herself to deal with her trauma, out of it came something even better than survival. There, what came with it was a certain wisdom, a certain understanding of life, a certain appreciation, a healthier functioning that was almost transcendent, beyond what you would expect. You know, if a kid falls in a pool and is drowning and we rescue them, they are survivors, right? if a kid learns from that experience not to run on the edge of the pool and be in dangerous situations, or learns how to swim so this doesn't happen again, aren't they thrivers to some degree? And I think that's the brilliance of post-traumatic growth. Now, the skepticism I have is there is a world that really likes labels and diagnoses, and post-traumatic stress disorder at least doesn't blame the victim as much. It really focuses more on the events of the trauma and the experience of the trauma. I hope that in the vernacular, resiliency and post-traumatic growth really become more forefront, because they just speak to something transformative that all of us go through at different levels. But, you know, with reference to adoptees, a lot of it is, who am I and who will I be? And what is my experience? Who will I connect to? A really profound sense of personal discovery. And, you know, we should all do that. We should all have a little post-traumatic growth. But I love the idea and I love the concept, because it's optimistic. It means this is not an anchor on your leg that will weigh you down the rest of your life. It may be something that you address the rest of your life, but it also may be something that provides you some profound transcendence.
Yeah. Wow, that is profound. And some people said, I don't know who said this to me. Somebody said something. I'm laughing. Obviously, you're a bit deep, Simon. And I can't remember whether I said it or just thought it. And my answer was internally or externally. Well, would you prefer me to be too shallow? I'm as shallow as the next guy. Next guy. I'm looking forward to a beer in a couple of hours. I drink caffeine. I eat red meat. You know, I've got an obsession with a certain brand of quite expensive jeans, you know. I'm not a monk, but I would rather, you know, I don't think that you're clearly a man of depth, and that depth is why you do what you do. And we live in a world that is pretty shallow.
We do. And again, I don't know that we all need to approach supporting each other as philosophers, but when you have sort of a mission, okay, and all of this comes from my mission, my dad, who I thought was a very smart guy before he passed away, said to me one time, an organization may have a mission, but you have a mission, and whatever organization or whatever you do in life, that mission goes with you. So what I would say to people that want to help adoptees is, know your mission before you start looking at specific skills or advices or things like that, and really operate from that mission. And I'll tell you, as an executive director, people say, oh, you must have to make hard decisions. We have almost 400 people that work here. And I tell them, I said, it's not that hard if you follow our stated values and our mission. It really isn't that hard. If you're not following that, then you're at risk of making biased decisions or self-serving decisions. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, helpers should know why they help and what it means to them, and then approach things with humility. And what I would say to adoptees is, don't stop asking the questions. If you're asking questions, those questions are meaningful. And there will be sometimes probably people don't want to hear the questions, or they will slam the door in your face and say, you don't need to know that. If those questions arise, at least from my experience in working with adoptees, they're meaningful. They're bubbling up in terms of your identity formation. And it's okay to ask this. It's not your fault. And everyone should be able to ask questions that help them and guide them toward a greater sense of authentic identity. And I know that there are, I see shame on folks' faces or fear to ask those questions. I actually have a nephew who is adopted, and for the longest time, he was really concerned about asking any questions about his adoption. And when I asked him why, he said, well, I didn't want our family to think I didn't want to be here. I didn't know if you would get angry. And he said, and I was also scared to find the answers a little bit. But I think that question and having good folks around you, and they don't always need to be professionals, that can support you through that inquiry into who you are, is something I would hope we do for everybody, but it is especially salient for adoptees.
Yeah. Well, I did a Facebook Live on the identity thing this morning, I've kind of got my handle on it. But what's your take on identity and who we are?
Well, my take, well, let me give my disclaimer first. I'm not still sure who I'm going to be when I grow up, and I'm a work in progress. And I've accepted the fact that as I get older, I know less and less about the world, but my curiosity hasn't subsided. So I get more curious about myself and the world in which I live in, and accept a certain amount of ignorance that I don't know anything more than anyone else. But in terms of identity, part of my professional career, I've worked with adult male victims of child sexual abuse. And a big part of their experience was, who am I after this happened to me in my childhood? And it was so amazing to watch them grapple with that. So what I would say around trauma is people want to sort out what their trauma experience is. I think it is natural for us to do that. I think people that are afraid or uncomfortable to ask those questions or forbidden to ask those questions really try to do it in dysfunctional ways. And we always want people to ask those questions in healthy ways. We try to squelch our demons all sorts of kinds of ways. But for me, I think we're all on an identity journey, but I think it is different when you've had significant trauma. And when I say trauma related to adoptees, I don't want an adoptee or an adoptive family to hear me suggesting that it necessarily is negative. But from my experience, it is a trauma. And I don't want trauma to be kind of a negative thing in the sense, but it is something that has abruptly affected an individual's physical and psychological sense of self and who they are. And we have those all through our lifetime. So for me, identity is, you're always a work in progress. The painting's never done. That's why I love paintings in museum that are incomplete, because I think they speak to the fact that that's the human experience, isn't it? So I think people just grapple with identity all along the line, but adoptees, there's some very core aspects to why am I not with my birth family? How am I like this family I'm with? How am I different? What does this mean? What's unique about me? What's similar to me? I'll use a great tangible example with my nephew again. He was a blonde-haired boy, and the rest of us all had a little darker hair. And he came in from outside one time and had taken mud and put it over his blonde hair so he could look like the rest of us. And there were, what that spoke to was some feeling of difference and some feeling of hopefully wanting to belong and a connection. But that's very significant in terms of people's identity, is who am I?
Yeah.
He's an adult now, but he got into a little bit of trouble and his uncle had to come take him for a car ride, meaning me. And I think he was worried. This is after he had been with us for 15 years of his 18 year life. he was worried we were going to reject him and kick him out of the family. And I had to look at him and say, listen, you're one of us. You'll always be one of us. We're blessed to have you. But now I need to tell you that before I chew your butt out so that you understand I do this with everybody that I love in this family. And you don't get any special treatment because you're a member of the family. But even at that age, is there still a chance that I'm going to lose this? Or what else is there in my life? And what was my birth situation like? And who am I going to be? And what don't I know about myself? And as you know, Simon, a lot of people that will reunite with their birth families, that's really mixed. Sometimes it's positive, sometimes it's negative. It's a lot of different things. We used to do as an organization some adoption search for birth children to find their families. And I was surprised that it's the full gamut. It can be very positive for some, and for others, it can be an additional trauma and heart wrenching. But the reason those people were doing it was that identity piece, to come full circle to that, is I really just want to know what that missing puzzle piece looks like. And how do I continue to construct my puzzle without knowing that piece? What's the picture going to look like?
Yeah. It's interesting for me. I've done a lot of my kind of consciousness learning and that sort of stuff with non-adoptees, if that's a word, but you know, and a lot of them don't feel like they fit in either. You know, I call this pinning the tail on the wrong donkey. So when we are in the dark, when we're kind of feeling a bit lost, we can often pin the tail on the wrong donkey because we can't see where we're going, and we attribute everything to, like, okay, well, that must be an adoption issue. No, that's a human issue.
Correct.
It's a human issue. And you talked earlier on about being, a victim of something that has happened in the past. You know, that is something that's happened in our past is always going to have a hold on us and always going to tether us to a certain point. And the more we attribute what is human to adoption or trauma or rape or whatever, you know, the more we attribute it, it becomes a more of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely. We call that trauma identity, is that you organize your sense of identity around whatever that trauma was. And it was interesting that you say that. When I used to do groups with male victims of child sexual abuse, the first thing I would say to them is, welcome, gentlemen. I do not see survivors of child sexual abuse. I see men. And I see men that are on a journey like I am, in a lifetime trying to figure out their lives. Because what I didn't want them to do was to organize their identity around a trauma. And a lot of people do that. And I will say there are a lot of professionals that also reinforce that. You know, people don't think that therapy, for example, can have side effects, but just like medication can, there can be damage done in therapy. There can be unintended consequences. I mean, hopefully good therapists help guide people. But one of the things I've seen is to reinforce that you are organized around this specific trauma. And the truth is, if we do this right, we shrink the importance of that trauma in your life and give you that wide open space of possibility.
Yeah, that's so true. I love the word shrink in that twice. Shrink as in shrink and shrink. Yeah.
Yeah, because my vocabulary is not as extensive, Simon. So sometimes I gotta use words more than once.
As you were talking about this, you know, we're talking about identity and identification, you know, trauma identity, and obviously I'm on the other side of the pond. So we see a lot of British cop shows, and a lot of American cop shows. I like cop shows. And there's always a detective who is usually, you know, getting a divorce. He's sometimes called Hank, but he can be called anything. And he goes to AA meetings, and they identify, you know, they, you know, hello. I won't try and do an American accent. Okay. Hello, my name is Hank, and I'm an alcoholic. And that, you know, that as soon as I say that, I think, who am I to criticize an organization that has changed so many lives for so many people, and the 12 steps, you know, the NA and all the different spin-offs from that. But whatever the good that they do, it doesn't start with that identification, does it? The good stuff that they're doing must be something else, because reinforcing a trauma identity or an alcoholic identity, to me, it's leading us further into the dark, isn't it? We're going to see we're going to see less clearly than that. Or maybe I've got it wrong. Maybe.
Well, yeah, I'm not an expert in AA, and I wouldn't I'll profess ignorance here. But my guess, if I had to speculate, what is the powerful factor, because AA is very, very effective, I think it's sort of the mutual aid. It's a community of people around you that it isn't hard for them to practice empathy because they've shared similar experiences. So to me, I think the whole acknowledgement of being an alcohol is keeping present the risk that one drink could send me spiraling down. So I have to accept that this is a chronic condition, for lack of a better word. You're right. In terms of how it infuses into their identity, I don't know. But I know the mutual aid. And I think that's the thing we've learned from AA is, to me, the best supports for people are just collectives around you that are going to listen and, again, be humble and practice empathy. And having gone to an AA meeting, a couple AA meetings with a friend of mine who was struggling with that, I went as support. It's palpable at what the support feels like and the sense of community. And again, I think that speaks to the power of our social connections in helping us figure out who we are, you know?
I've only seen the AA stuff on the telly, but here in the UK we also have I think you guys call it the AAA is the motor organization,
correct?
Yeah, so our AAA is called AA.
Is it really?
Or one of them, the Automobile Association. So don't get those mixed up, folks, just in case. I don't know. I do come up with some rubbish. The big thing about identity that I learned actually was a coach of mine, Liz, who was she works with a partner, you know, a partner in business, if you like, and a partner in life as well. She wanted to be adopted, okay, at two, because she was getting abused by her dad. She's getting physically abused by her dad, sexually abused by her dad, abused in every single way. But she couldn't, they wouldn't, for what even the reasons, the courts wouldn't accept her stuff. But she came through that eventually, the other side. And we spent a week talking about who we are not to get to who we are.
That's wonderful.
And who we are not is essentially the voice in our head, the voice in our head that tells us that we're not good enough. And as you know, adoptees, I've got a really good reason to think I'm not good enough. Don't mean it's true. It's a very compelling reason. Right. It's completely impossible. But all the other people in the other six or seven of us on the course for that week, they weren't adopted, but they didn't think that they were good enough too. And we learned together that we are not the voice in our head that says that we're not good enough. Some people might call that. So what are we? I see us as the, imagine a wall's being built. So the bricklayers come along, he's built this wall, and then a painter and decorator's come along and painted it white. You know, we're a blank canvas, we're a blank wall. That's who we are. And then we go through, and we're perfect and pristine. And that is the kind of like that's the metaphor for the unconditioned soul. Then we go through life, and people tell us, maybe we get bullied at school. Maybe a teacher tells us that we will never amount to anything. And it's like they're doing graffiti, profane, swearing, horrible slogans. They're writing slogans on our wall. And then we start to believe what they say. We start, and we take the aerosol can off them, and we start doing our own slogans about how manure we are, right? How much full of poop we are. But all that doesn't change the fact that we're the blank wall. We're not the writing on it.
That's a wonderful metaphor. And I actually wrote down who we are not as a question that I think you're right. I mean, that's a great question. I think that's a great question for everyone to ask. But, you know, we're susceptible to believing all the noise that comes at us from other people. And the more we believe it, the more the treads really get deep, you know, and that's such a challenge for any kind of victim of trauma. But like you mentioned with adoptees, there's sort of a big question mark that can be filled in with the wrong answers very easily. I mean, all it would take is for another kid to say to another kid, oh, you're adopted. Your parents didn't even love you. If you hear that as a child, okay, whether if it's not true or whatever, there is that spray painting that you're speaking of that leaves that in there. And it's a lot of noise that people have to unpack that a little bit, you know. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. So for me, the clearer that we can see our own perfection, the perfect wall, the perfect white wall, the clearer we can see that as adults, then the better our chance are of showing our adopted kids or the people that we work with. You've got 400, did you say you got 400 staff?
Correct.
Wow. So the clearer you can see this stuff and your managers, and the clearer that we can kind of point it out to other people.
Absolutely.
And the more likely, but they need to see it for themselves.
That's right.
To go back right to your point
it's a human to human exercise. And again, sometimes I'll be the first to say, you know, I have a doctorate in clinical social work, and maybe that sounds impressive and it came from an Ivy League school and blah, blah, blah. The truth of the matter is this is human to human interaction. It's not expert to subordinate. And again, I would just advocate for professionals to understand that, relate to whoever you're supporting as a human to human first. There will be a place to understand your area of expertise as it applies to this. But when we approach people as sort of expertise, I think we kind of shut the conversation off right away. You know, it's very easy for us to be in a position of power. And this is really, you know, there's a lot of letting go in self-discovery and helping people guide through that. And, you know, when I think of loss, grief and loss is such a big part of the adoptee experience, I like to think about loss in terms of losses and additions. In life, we have losses and we focus a lot on the losses and the trauma associated with losses, but we don't focus as much on the additions. So if you look at your life, what the additions are, both positive and negative, and kind of balance it with the losses, I think that's some of the crux of the identity work that people do, you know?
Yeah.
And it's very easy to focus on the losses more. I'll give you a recent example. My daughter, my 15-year-old daughter, had a friend this week whose father was killed in a motorcycle accident over the weekend. And of course, this is enormous loss. It's loss for everybody. Well, yesterday, my daughter went over and brought a basket for this friend where she bought all sorts of stuff she knows the friend likes and put a really nice card, but wanted to respect the fact that this is still very recent and that this friend probably didn't want to socialize. And she left it on the step for this little girl. And as we're driving away, what I was thinking about was the loss and also the addition of what this means now for my daughter, who has now learned how to exercise a certain amount of compassion and community for a friend that was that lost. There was something beautiful that was added, if that makes sense. And I witnessed it firsthand. I mean, I had to pay for it too, that part, you know, whatever. But driving home, I'm thinking, you know, out of this tragedy, something, this is a micro example of a flower blossoming and beauty growing, that there was an addition here. Yes, the tragedy and trauma is awful, but we don't think enough about additions. And I think that was just a recent example that just popped into my head of where something beautiful happened.
Yeah. And what a great metaphor for post-traumatic growth.
Absolutely.
I think that's a great place to bring it in, Rick.
Thank you again so much for this opportunity. And, I hope that your listeners, whatever they may be, however they may be connected to this, retain a certain optimism and a sense of possibility and know that there is blue ocean space ahead of you. It's not always easy to get there, but it is there. So I just encourage folks to continue to support each other, practice a sense of humility and empathy, empathy, empathy. And then when you're done with empathy, do some more empathy.
Great. And thanks again, Rick. And I'll put some links down to underneath in the show notes so people can find more about Voce. And that is a Latin for voice, yeah?
Correct. We're using the Italian spelling, and who would have been surprised with my Italian last name? And I also am a singer, so people think it was an inside job when we changed the name. But the truth was, we listened to the staff and what the staff basically said. This is who we are. We advocate, we use our voice, and then we help other people use their voice. It was such a beautiful organic process to arrive at this place. And I think it's so important. So I'm very proud of it.
I think, yeah, deservedly so. And it's been a team effort, and sounds like you've got a great team by a great leader who is still, I meant to bring this up earlier on, just after you said it, but it slipped past. So we've got a guy who leads 400 people with what sounds like a hell of a lot of wisdom to me, and who still doesn't consider himself grown up.
Simon, after this podcast, I could be running up and down the halls in here acting like a child. Who knows what happens? Well, you know, there's something. Who wants to be grown up? I mean, really, I don't want to be grown up. That's no fun.
Yeah.
You know? So.
I feel you, brother. Anyhow. Me too.
Sounds thanks good, buddy. All right. Thank you.
See you soon. Thanks, listeners. See you again soon.